The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
You're watching Sky News. Some sad breaking news to bring you. We're hearing in the last few moments that Jason Ardaie, the Cambridge professor who had been at the centre of a plagiarism inquiry, has been found dead. A spokesperson for the Met Police said the London Ambulance Service was called today at 3:12 p.m. Sadly, a 41-year-old man was pronounced dead at the scene. His next of kin have been informed and are being supported by officers. At this time, his death is being treated as unexpected, but is not believed to be suspicious. Well, Jason Ardaie, a professor of sociology of education, became Cambridge's youngest black professor in 2023. He quit following a series of media reports alleging that he plagiarised his PhD thesis, completed at Liverpool John Moores University, and other research. Further questions were asked in the press about the truth of other claims he made, including saying he ran 600 miles in 6 days and that he'd raised £5.5 million for charity. An investigation at Liverpool John Moores University cleared Professor Ardaie of wrongdoing, but we do know that the University of Cambridge is running an independent review of all relevant processes alongside an investigation into how a professor who resigned amid a plagiarism row was appointed by its Faculty of Education.
It's not a moment for any rushing to judgment. It's a moment for reflection, I would say. Reflecting on how things came to this. A really sad and sorry state of affairs. And I think we just all today think of Jason, his contribution, and his family and friends.
Jason Ardaie was once held up as a symbol of what British academia could be. Now his death is a reckoning over duty of care, institutional failure, media scrutiny, and racism. The Cambridge professor resigned last week after allegations of plagiarism and that parts of his life were exaggerated or made up. Ardaie admitted errors in his work but denied plagiarism. The 41-year-old was clearly struggling when he stepped down, saying in a statement, "What I have experienced has gone far beyond scholarly disagreement." The stories went deep into his personal life.
In the last 9 days, there was 188 newspaper articles about Jason Ardaie, right? You do not see that same level of scrutiny, that same level of coverage about other cases of plagiarism, other cases of people exaggerating their CVs.
Is it because he was a black professor?
There is no doubt that the fact that he was a black man was a contributory factor, if not the major factor, as to why the coverage that he received and the coverage of the case he received.
Some allege conservative figures are targeting black academics in a war on diversity.
The media coverage on this story out of the UK, really and truly deranged. Anything and everything, any excuse to cry racism, to say racism, white racism against blacks is what caused this. Ephraim and Manasseh, there's a sickness that has set in, and it's just a case of one professor I know. It's not an overarching subject to begin the show with, but it really and truly does typify so much of what's wrong with our nations, with Ephraim and Manasseh. We saw during the Obama years, President Obama would just pounce on any opportunity to say there's racism in the DNA of whites. The man killed himself, so he's to blame. The circumstances leading up to it is the fact that he was a total fraud, and that he was exposed as a fraud. And so of course, the villain here, the villain, that would be the people who exposed the fraud. Not the perpetrators of the crime, the fraud, the lying, certainly not. It's the people who expose the evil. They're to blame, as you heard there in the cold open. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is The Trumpet Daily. We appreciate you joining us on today's show. Lots and lots to get to. You can get to the live video stream of this program at our website, thetrumpet.com, or at the Rumble channel, the YouTube channel. You can email the show, td@thetrumpet.com. So by the way, pretty big news stack today. A big day for news. We won't be able to cover all of the subjects that look pretty interesting to our news gatherers, but hopefully we'll have some extra stories for, if not a Trumpet Daily, for some other lectures, forums, and that sort of thing as we go forward. But this story out of the UK, if you build your life on a foundation of lies or fakery or phoniness, think about Judas. In the Gospels, he went off and committed suicide as well because he was exposed. He was exposed, and he had no one to blame but himself. He had the opportunity to build his life on truth and to be a follower of Christ. Obviously, suicide under any circumstances is a tragic end to someone's physical life. And it happens way more often than you would think, particularly in Ephraim and Manasseh, where we're just hopped up on drugs constantly to try to keep ourselves, what, sane or normal? Drugged up, whether it's over-the-counter drugs, marijuana, alcohol, you name it. So many ills in society today. As I say, this one in particular really does typify so much of what's wrong with Ephraim. The media coverage has just been not even just deranged. It's important that we understand how dangerous this intellectual leaven is, as Herbert Armstrong often called it. The intellectual leaven in higher education. The man was exposed as a fraud. You know, Cambridge has its part in the blame here for propping it up, for perpetuating it. All these easily disprovable facts or ideas, padding the resume, whatever you want to call it. And all these children, by the way, flocking to Cambridge to sit in on the lectures of this youngest black professor in Cambridge's history, listening to him talk about popular culture or whatever it is that he wanted to discuss that day. Not qualified at all. Listen to some of the woke commentary. I'm devastated for the family and friends of Jason Arday. He faced unacceptable public hounding and campaign of abuse. I know many Londoners will be angry and upset this evening. Jason Arday was the victim of a pernicious public shaming that other people in his position simply wouldn't have faced. That's from Sadiq Khan on X. All these prominent people, these radical leftists coming forward, eager to bury the truth, eager to promote opinions, human opinions, will worship. We did a program last week. Where's the booklet? Here it is. It's right in front of me. Overcoming the God of this world. Satan and his demons are real. They certainly are. In Epistles of Paul, we've been going through, you know, Paul's early life leading up to his conversion in Acts 9. It's fascinating history. And you see in Acts 7 and Acts 8, here's Paul. He's breathing threatenings out against God's people. He's persecuting Christians, putting them in prison, in jail. And even consenting to their death, like he did with Stephen. You see that at the end of Acts 7. And then, you know, we jumped ahead to Acts 9 and the road to Damascus and Paul turning it all around through repentance. And yet, right in the middle of that, you've got Acts 8, this history about Simon Magus, and how that Samaria was just infested with demons and people worshiping this Simon Magus as a god, worshiping his opinions. And he was, in fact, a tool of the devil. Paul was being used by the devil to persecute true Christians, and Christians were scattered because of the persecution. And Paul said, well, if they spread out, let's go to Damascus and hunt them down there. And then God struck him down, struck him blind on the way to Damascus. And he had to be led into the city by the hand. And for 3 days and three nights, he's blind. And God speaks to Paul in vision. He speaks to Ananias in the same way and says, go over to this apostle Paul. And Ananias said, well, he's killing Christians. I don't want to have anything to do with him. God said, listen, he's a chosen vessel. He's a changed man. He turned away from his sinful way of life. He turned away from the fakery and the phoniness of Satan's religion. And now he's out there serving God. You see how far removed we are from God's law, from the truth. The truth sets you free. And so here's this incident in the UK, and it's the truth. In the end, it's the truth that's cast to the ground. It's the truth that's buried. That's what gets lost in this story now. Instead of facing the truth, instead of humbling himself in repentance and faith, he chooses to end his life. And then the intellectual journalists of our day rush to tell you that, well, it's your fault, or it's conservative media's fault. White conservative media. Here's a leftist British MP. If Jason Arday were a white, middle-class academic, he would not have been hounded by the British press the way that he was. Another, Ibram X. Kendi, a prominent activist from the radical left. It says, to be a prominent anti-racist black scholar is to know you are a target, almost totally surrounded by resentments. How deranged and dangerous can the reasoning be? Here, at the same time, this doesn't involve race, but you've got the Luigi guy that shot that CEO in the back because, well, the CEO deserved it, the radical left says. He had it coming. Here's a case where they actually cheer on the murderer. Or in the case of the guy who commits suicide, they blame white conservative media. Meanwhile, just so that you know, Germany is building a war machine. Germany is empowering its intelligence agencies. NATO is providing cover for a new European army. And America, by the way, is clearing the way, cheering it on, completely unprepared for what's coming. The attacks are wielded by racist propagandists resenting you for shining a light on anti-black racism. So says that Ibram Kendi. The attacks come from centrist and progressive white scholars and writers resenting your positions and honors and pay. Here the guy was a total fraud, an embarrassment, a stain on Cambridge, a DEI hire. And now look at how the story. Look at how the story is told now. Look at the narrative that's so quickly and easily created around lies. Listen to this from Channel 4 over in the UK, clip 5.
But I do want to stress here, this isn't just a tragedy. A man was lynched yesterday. Like, when you talk about those amount of articles, and you can't just blame Cambridge University. This is the media. This is 188 articles. This is constant scrutiny. This is people outside of his house, even today when he's died. This is unprecedented. And I want to stress this very clearly. If he was white, he would still be alive. I would have said before it was metaphorically a lynching, but like I said, he's now dead because he's black. What else do we call that but a public lynching of this man?
He was lynched, this guy says. Brandon O'Neill at Spiked. Only one person bears responsibility for our day's death, and that's Jason Arday. He and he alone was the author of his ultimate untimely demise. To call his death murder, far less a lynching, is a crime against the truth. It robs Arday himself of moral agency. There is inverted racial bigotry here, the presumption being that a black man could not possibly have authored his own destruction. It's a strong message from Brandon O'Neill. To scrub such truths from the record is not pro-black. It's a nauseating crusade of condescension that reduces blacks to blameless entities undeserving of the scrutiny that other races receive. Well, that's a good point. What if the races were? The radical left is saying the conservative media went after him because he was black. Well, what if it was a white scholar? Or would-be scholar, or fake scholar. And look at, and the other thing too about the media is look at how little it takes for them to destroy lives, even innocent lives. And now they're lecturing us about, you don't report on this. If he's a fraud and he's a minority, let him be a fraud. Let him keep teaching. He was anti-racist. He was against racism. How could you destroy his life? How could you lynch him? What does this say about people who were actually lynched in history? That's what passes for news, what you heard right there. This O'Neill piece. He titles it, "A Suicide Is Not a Lynching." The grossest thing in the lynching lie is the implicit suggestion that reportage is murder, that digging for the truth is a potential death sentence for the vulnerable, that saying untoward things about a professor who happens to be black is by definition racist, and possibly even KKK and its consequences. O'Neill says this is a grotesque slander against journalists whose only intention was to uncover the truth about our day and the powerful institutions that employed and flattered him. That's what Cambridge did. They just flattered him. He's black. He's a DEI hire. He's young. It fits perfectly with our agenda. Well, until the whited sepulcher came crashing down. Listen to a bit more from Channel 4, clip 6.
Prime Minister says this should be a moment for national reflection. Reflection upon what is most important from your perspective as his friend?
It has to be the fact that the Prime Minister is talking about Jason Arday. This is somebody who previously was completely unknown, has become a household name because of a racist smear campaign from the right, which we should have pushed back on and said, this is a terrible story. But sadly, the rest of the media joined in, and now it's become, that's the story. How is the media reporting this? How is the media allowing themselves to be led by these racist right-wing ideas? That's what the inquiry should be about.
If you're gonna focus on anyone other than Arday, how about the folks at Cambridge? How about the administrators that hired him? How about those that put him up on a pedestal and had young people practically worship him? How about the institution that took him in and then just covered up the lies? Well, the lies don't matter. He's a DEI hire. It gives us diversity. Douglas Murray. He says here, Arday's memoir is a terrible list of people purportedly telling him what a godlike force he is. That is no exaggeration. The passages were disturbing before his death and now sound simply tragic. At the time of his birth, Arday relates, the midwife who delivered him into the world told his mother, "This boy is destined for great things, you hear? You take care of this child." telling her son this story. His mother says, "I don't know what that woman did to you when she delivered you, Jason, but I always feel like she blessed you with something because you have some truly exceptional gifts. And the things that you've done and experienced are inexplicable." Everyone, well, if we believe this, it's probably him making it up, but supposing this is true, well, everyone told him how perfect he was, how wonderful he was. It's again, a perfect illustration of all that's wrong in Israelite nations. There seems to have been an unlimited supply of people willing to speak similarly to him. For instance, we're told early in the book that as part of my job, I'm often asked to give talks all around the country and the world. Every time I do, people come up to me afterwards, always with the same question: how do you do it? Our day was surrounded and promoted by real flatterers once he entered the academy. Is this a good thing? When you're surrounded by people who just tell you all the time how great you are, you never get any criticism, any negative feedback, any correction. You read through Acts 9 and you see a loving father who set Paul apart from birth, by the way. That's in Galatians 1. You see a loving father who smote him, who struck him blind. Paul heard a voice. He heard the voice of Jesus Christ and said, "Why are you fighting me? Why are you fighting against my work? Why are you persecuting my people?" And Paul was at a crossroads. And what if Paul just said, "I'm not going to obey you. I'm not going to follow your steps. I'm making good money persecuting Christians. I'm becoming well known in Jerusalem, in Damascus, all over the place." What does it say in Philippians? Paul could have just wallowed in self-pity, self-despair. Look at Philippians 3. Just to hit one more scripture quickly. Philippians chapter 3, I think it's verse 8 maybe. It says, "Yea, doubtless, and I count all things but loss for the excellency of the knowledge of Jesus Christ my Lord, for whom I have suffered the loss of all things." Paul lost everything, disowned even by his family and friends, all the fame and the fortune and the prestige, the celebrity, one of the best-known persecutors of Christians, that filthy lot, just doing God a service, getting rid of those Christians, locking them in prison. Paul lost all of that worldliness. And it says, "And do count them but dung, that I may win Christ." So Paul didn't run from the correction. He won Christ. He brought God into his life. And he made a 180-degree turn. And it's one of the greatest stories of repentance in the whole Bible. Very inspiring. You see why we need God's truth when you just see so much will worship, so much worshiping of opinions. It's God's truth that breaks us free from that. It's reasoning together with God that breaks us free from that. It says here, as we learned even before the publication of his memoir, our day was not above implying that anyone who criticized him was a bigot. And so all of the talking heads that are lining up to say the same thing, I guess disciples of our day, you're a bigot. You're a racist. For telling the truth, for exposing lies, at Cambridge, one of the most distinguished and reputable educational institutions in the world. Dave Harris, an emeritus professor at Plymouth Marjan University in England, wrote to him about some plagiarism concerns. Instead of spending your time trying to dismantle racism and ableism, you have spent what I assume is hours combing through my work looking for mistakes, Arde replied. Anything further from you will be considered bullying and harassment. He wouldn't take correction. He couldn't take correction. He couldn't admit he was wrong. And then it all comes crashing down. And the reason it came crashing down is because there were some people out there actually concerned about the truth. Telling the truth. Telling the truth to those students going into Cambridge, sitting in on our day's lectures, exposing the truth. There's a sickness, isn't there? There's a sickness in higher education, and as I've also noted in epistles, this school year already, we're just off and running, but the Apostle Paul was highly educated in the Pharisaical system of education of his day. He was of the straightest sect of the Pharisees, brought up in a strict Pharisaical household. His dad was a Pharisee, highly educated, taught at the feet of Gamaliel, at the school of Hillel in Jerusalem. And that's unusual. This same Paul wrote in 1 Corinthians 1 that God generally calls the lowly of this world because the high and mighty, the intellectually vain, they won't humble themselves. They won't confess their sins. They won't admit errors. Paul was different. He was a scholar. Before conversion, he was a scholar who admitted error. But even there, God, Galatians 1 says God had to take him into Arabia where he received revelation from Jesus Christ, the resurrected Jesus Christ. God had to deprogram Paul in many ways. He had to unlearn so much of what he was steeped in as a Pharisaical scholar. And God gave him the truth of the gospel. Herbert Armstrong, years ago, he wrote this article, I forget what year, 60s or 70s, but it was The Dangerous Leaven of Higher Education. One of our news gatherers mentioned this podcast that Neil Ferguson was on, the UK historian, a couple years ago, The Treason of the Intellectuals. What is wrong with higher education that we would produce these kinds of intellectuals or invite certain ones in that aren't intellectuals at all, and then praise them, and then promote them, and put them on a pedestal, and pretend, and tell lies effortlessly. Ferguson, in this discussion he had, he connects the intellectuals of the 1930s that, you know, they were good academic intellectuals that also supported Hitler. But that's okay. They were smart. They were willing to turn a blind eye to all the atrocities, to all of the evil, to all of the oppression, the genocide, even the genocide. He compares the intellectuals of the 1930s to the intellectuals of today that celebrated October 7. Another massacre, another genocide. Hamas just pouring into southern Israel so that they could kill Jews, just Jews, men, women, children. So what do you do with that? The scriptures about Paul, they say he was on his way to Damascus to put men and women in prison. It didn't matter. Women, children. Paul put some of them to death. If they were Christian, he put them to death or he put them in prison. And what's the way out of that? Repentance. You have to change. Your heart has to change. And you start, You have to start looking into God's opinions, his reasonings, his truth, his way of life, and you have to follow God. This world is not following God. It's been off course since Genesis 3 and trying to make its way, trying to figure it out, trying to solve one crisis after another, the intellectual leaven, the danger of intellectual leaven, you know, in the discussion that Ferguson had on that podcast a couple of years ago, he talked about the German PhD system, the German rationalism that spread into Western education, into the United States and Britain. And Herbert Armstrong wrote about this in his writings. And Professor Bloom in Closing of the American Mind, he's got a chapter in there on German rationalism. Higher education is dangerous. It's dangerous. This is why we caution our young people to just do everything that they can. Get some of, go in for a class here and there, maybe go to vocational training, look to a mentor, come to Armstrong College, but do not immerse yourself into the university environment of Western education, because look at what it produces. Just looking at the fruits alone. And then every once in a while, you have these kinds of cases where you have a total fraud exposed. And then look at how the very well-educated tell the story once he commits suicide. Look at the blame they assign. How's this kind of a system going to get solved? Or how's it going to improve? Or when will, or how will there be a healing in the university environment? God says, come and let us reason together. Notice, he wants our thoughts. He wants our input. He wants us to be able to express an opinion, but he also wants for us to grab hold of his reasoning and to build our life around it. He wants dialogue with us. He wants discussion. He wants robust dialogue. He wants to educate us. But we fight against it. We run away from it. This other article, just again, to look at the sickness in Britain. The Times says, British police make 30 arrests a day for offensive online messages. 30 arrests per day. Meanwhile, this is for woke crimes. I might have mentioned this story before. Custody data obtained by the Times shows that officers are making about 12,000 arrests a year under the Malicious Communications Act. 12,000 arrests. And think about how many perpetrators get away with or almost get away with rape, murder, robbery, crime. There's a wokester in the Northeast that's saying we should no longer prosecute for shoplifting. If somebody goes into, you know, Walgreens and steals toothpaste, oh, they're only doing it because they need it and they can't afford it and they've got to take care of their teeth. That's derangement. That's lawlessness. That's anarchy that's being promoted. And you see the same danger just out there promoting lies with respect to this case in the UK. It's quoting one officer saying, given that only 11% of the violent and sexual offense cases in England and Wales were closed after a suspect was caught or charged in the year to June 2024, a steep decline on previous years, it seems extraordinary that the police are wasting so much time arresting people for hurty words, offensive words, so much time, so much effort, so many resources for offensive speech, and not so much for rape, murder, pillage, burglary, stealing, theft, all those things. Building up a distinguished academic career based upon a foundation of fraudulent material. And then you get called on the carpet for it and you say, hey, you need to fight racism. Stop fighting me. Stop looking at my thesis. Stop accusing me of plagiarism. With Hamas, look at the very academic diplomats, the highly educated diplomats that want to go and talk with Hamas and try to help them reason and try to show them the way to peace. We've been there so many times before. I think Kushner and his party, they're heading over there now, or maybe they're there. This report might say, I didn't listen to this clip beforehand, but this is from France 24, clip 7.
After a rare meeting with the leader of Hamas, U.S. negotiator and president, and the president's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, is in Israel and set to meet with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Netanyahu has openly rejected the U.S.-backed roadmap towards peace in Gaza. Hamas has agreed to start disarming if Israel stops bombing Gaza and withdraws its troops to behind a so-called yellow line. Israel says Hamas has to hand over absolutely all of their weapons first.
Hamas promises to lay down their weapons if Israel just stops bombing, if Israel just stops targeting them in this counteroffensive. After following October 7, Kushner, of course, he meets with Hamas first. It's important that you get the order right because you get an assurance from Hamas and then you go and put the pressure on Bibi. He's running for re-election. He rejected the 15-point peace plan. Bibi's the bad guy. And Hamas is the victim. You see how it works? The perpetrators of the lies, of the murder, they are victims. And Israel is the villain. Certainly Bibi is the villain. This is from the Daily Mail. It says here, President Trump sent his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, into a surprise meeting with Hamas leaders in an attempt to get them to disarm. Kushner, the U.S. Special Envoy for Peace, met with leaders of the Islamist terrorist group on Sunday, that would be yesterday, in Egypt. He's due to meet with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu today. The focus of the unusual meetup was to translate Hamas's duty to demilitarize Gaza into concrete, verifiable steps. So we're almost 3 years on from October 7, still trying to talk Hamas into disarming. It's all over the place, isn't it? Worshipping human opinions, thinking, finally, I'm going to be able to talk some sense into them. Finally, human reasoning is going to solve this. God says, come, let us reason together. The Board of Peace's roadmap calls for Israel to gradually withdraw its forces from Gaza as Hamas disarms, a sequence Netanyahu made clear he will not accept. Well, hasn't Hamas made it clear that they will not accept any terms of peace or a peaceful disarmament? You know what the history is, the recent history at that. Here's one more from France 24, clip 8.
The fact that Jared Kushner, the president's son-in-law, as you said, is coming here is significant. Neither he nor Steve Witkoff, the president's envoy, have been here in many months. That absolutely is a symptom of the fact that the White House and Prime Minister Netanyahu really haven't been on the same page. But Netanyahu's choice to go public and to really explicitly oppose a plan being personally advanced by Donald Trump does seem to have provoked this letter that we saw yesterday by eight Muslim nations condemning Netanyahu somehow making trouble, putting obstacles ahead of this Gaza plan, and this visit by Jared Kushner. We should mention, Prime Minister Netanyahu has known Jared Kushner for almost Kushner's entire life. Netanyahu has been friendly with his parents and even stayed in Jared Kushner's childhood room during one visit decades ago to the United States. But this time is different. And the fact that the president's son-in-law, 3 years after the attacks of October 7th, met with Hamas leaders, that goes completely against United States official policy of not talking to terrorists, not giving any kind of legitimacy to terrorists. The fact that these terrorists now are the first people in the Middle East who Jared Kushner consulted with ahead of coming to Jerusalem today, this is significant, and this is a sign probably of a tough meeting down the road today.
The tough meeting is the one in Israel. Meet with the terrorists first, and then go over to Israel and try to hammer away at Bibi. Try to get Israel to submit. This is from JNS. Let's skip ahead to number 11.
Hamas is reconstituting. It's really that simple. Hamas, over the last 8 months, Hamas committed to demilitarizing. President Trump's entire agreement, the first point is, the first word is the de-radicalization of Gaza. Gaza will not pose a threat to its neighbors. And the entire agreement is premised on the idea that Hamas is going to disarm. They've been doing the exact opposite. They've recruited their soldiers. I have videos showing. I can see them walking around with loaded guns around all the food trucks. They've increased their munitions. We've caught them doing 7 different drills that are practicing against Israel. Hezbollah is not, they're not in a vacuum. They're growing, meaning they are re-recruiting, they're being more and more aggressive, and Israel's holding the line, but as the Prime Minister has been very clear in saying, this is not a situation that's going to stay where it is. Right now, we're happy for the United States to try to move in and actually disarm Hamas. We prefer if they can do it, that we don't have to do it, but at the end of the day, we're not going to allow Hamas to continue growing and metastasizing back to where it was before.
The divide, it's getting bigger between the U.S. and Israel. And, of course, that's very significant with respect to Bible prophecy. As far as Israel's northern border, this is from Zero Hedge. Despite a June ceasefire technically being in effect, new weekend Israeli attacks on southern Lebanon mark the deadliest escalation since fighting largely came to a halt earlier this year. So there's escalation up north as well. This is what JNS had to say on that. Clip 10.
Yeah, this is really the thing that people cannot grasp. As a matter of fact, I was just speaking to my mom, who called me. She's an American, asked what happened in Lebanon. I said, Mom, the world cannot really understand how evil these people are. They attacked our forces in the security zone. So according to the security zone, you're talking just a few miles from the Israeli border. Our boys are dismantling infrastructure. A suicide drone comes and attacks them in contravention of the agreement that was made, the ceasefire agreement. Then they probably know, based on Israeli intelligence, that we are going to find out where that order came from and strike. So what does the guy do? He takes, apparently, civilians, according to what I'm reading, his own family, and moves them into a military headquarters. I mean, who would do that? What's he thinking? He's thinking what? Maybe somebody's going to notice and we're not going to strike. Or when we strike and eliminate him, then he sacrifices his entire family so then he can point in his death, point a finger at Israel and say, you killed civilians.
I thought he looked familiar. That's Doron Spielman. I've met him before. He used to work with the City of David, helped us some years ago with some research. I saw there on the lower third that he's now a spokesperson for the Prime Minister's office. So they're concerned about their security. They're hoping America would come in there and just demand, insist that Hamas or Hezbollah disarm. But there was a story from, I forget who it was from, Lee Smith, I think it was, how Hezbollah's not disarming. Remember about 2 seconds ago when the Lebanese army, after getting the flow of funding from America, just eager to hand out billions and billions, and the Lebanese leader in the White House not that long ago, assuring President Trump, yeah, well, we are going to defang Hezbollah, no doubt about it. It's not happening. And Hamas, just giving their word, we'll lay down our arms, so long as Israel stops being aggressive, as long as Israel stops going on the offensive. Look at how easy it is for Western-educated intellectuals to believe terrorists, to believe frauds, to embrace fakery, to consume it, to swallow it. There's a story at American Greatness. I just want to get through a couple more here. Europe's coming existential crisis. Americans pay little attention to Europe, it says. We don't pay attention to Europe. It says, but I am also aware of the coming existential crisis facing Europe as a whole and the European Union quite specifically. There are crises coming. This guy here, this commentator at American Greatness says, you know, I'm guilty too. Yeah, I make fun of the European bureaucrats, but aside from that, I pretty much ignore the continent. Which is exactly what the devil prefers. Just ignore what's coming out of the heart of Europe. Just ignore Bible prophecy. Just ignore reasoning with God. Forget about it. You can work this out. You've got highly educated people. And there's nothing dangerous about education, certainly not. It says here, first is the shock and the embarrassment posed by the influx of 72,000 North African Muslim wannabe migrants in Soweto. You know about that story. We talked about that a few weeks ago. Immigration's been a long simmering issue. Further on, it says EU citizens rail incessantly over the often ridiculous regulations. So he's talking about just the authoritarian ways of the bureaucrats, the EU leadership. It says it's a running joke that a young Swedish girl could get gang raped by Syrian immigrants and the police wouldn't lift a finger. But if a farmer got caught killing a wolf, they would exhaust every investigative and prosecutorial resource to put him away for years. It quotes some guy later in the article saying there's a super authoritarian governance. And again, it's more coming from these globalist bureaucrats at the moment. But what happens when this super authoritarian governance is spearheaded by the Daniel 8 man? You know, the one who comes in by flatteries? Everybody just telling him, you're doing great. You're perfect. You're the perfect man for the job. I mean, if you've got plagiarism in your background, no, that's no problem. We'll cover that up. We've got the intellectuals, the sycophants. They're all around. Everything's in place. Just do what needs to be done. You've got to stand against Orange Hitler. And then you've got Putin. You've got the perfect excuse to build a new military machine. And furthermore, America's totally asleep. America's not paying attention. America doesn't care about Europe. Perfect storm. Just as Christ described in the Olivet prophecy, just as Daniel the prophet described the Apostle John in Revelation. It says, down the road, Europe will become increasingly authoritarian and increasingly centralized. Wow. Down another road, Europe will return to its roots. Well, I'm not sure he understands what he means by that, or at least what I take it to mean. He probably means something a little different. But what happens when Europe returns to its roots? Is anybody concerned about this? In America? The Atlantic. It has a story here on NATO's nightmare. Western military planners do not seem eager to talk about their nightmare scenario, much less prepare for it. but they tend to agree on how it would begin, a coordinated near simultaneous attack on opposite sides of the planet in which Russia targets a NATO member in Eastern Europe while China makes its move against Taiwan. The U.S. military would need to react on two fronts at once, three if it remains at war in the Middle East. It says, until recently, this possibility sat at the more outlandish end of the threat spectrum, somewhere between a loose nuke and an alien invasion. Well, it's not so far-fetched anymore. What does the Bible say about tidings that come out of the East? Russia, China, and what Europe does to preempt it. The stage is being set. The European war machine is being constructed. And right now it's receiving the blessing of America. It's got the cover of NATO and people cheering it on because, well, you've got to stand against Trump and Putin. And meanwhile, I haven't had time to get to this story recently. German cabinet passes controversial intelligence agency reform. They're empowering the intel agencies in Germany. Listen to this clip from DW News, clip 16.
Can you explain why Germany has been so reluctant or perhaps unable to give those agencies more power?
Yes, in Germany that has historical reasons. So when we had the Nazi regime, we had the Gestapo, the secret state police here that helped the regime to terrorize Jews and terrorize the population. And we learned from that experience, and we would never want to have that happen again. So then when the constitution was made in the 40s and 50s and even 60s in Germany, that was what we had in mind, to prevent that from happening again. So that's why we created a strict separation between what is police and what is secret services. And from that on, we had that always in our constitution, in our bloodline, so to say. That's different from other countries. But of course, nowadays we face a new threat that we have to tackle with maybe even new laws or regulations or changes.
Notice the reference to history there at the beginning of that clip. She says, well, we've been reluctant to empower these intel agencies because of our past, the Nazi regime, the Gestapo, the state police. This article about empowering the intel agencies. The government says the package aims to enable the agencies to operate more effectively in the face of a myriad of hybrid security threats. See, we have to do it. They've got the cover. It's the perfect cover, for sure. In Colossians 2, this is the section about worshiping opinions. It says, let no man beguile you of your reward in a voluntary humility and worshiping of demons, intruding into those things which he has not seen, vainly puffed up by his fleshly mind, vainly puffed up, intellectual vanity. It says further, which things have a show of wisdom and will worship and humility and neglecting of the body, not in any honor to the satisfying of the flesh. I mean, it looks wise. It seems intellectual. It seems like it's higher education. But like I said in that program on overcoming Satan, What does God say? What does Paul say in Ephesians 6 about going against evil in high places? You better be careful with higher education, with trusting in man, as Jeremiah 17 says, with trusting human opinions. God says, let's reason together. God says, let's reason with him. You don't need to reason your way around this tragic story in the UK of a man taking his own life because he was exposed as a fraud. Just tell the truth. Tell the truth when it comes to Hamas and its charter or Hezbollah. People don't want that. They want to worship opinions. They want to think that they know better than God. That verse that I keep mentioning. It's Isaiah 1 and verse 18. Come now and let us reason together, saith the Lord. Though your sins be as scarlet, God will sit down. There is no more scarlet-colored sins quite like the ones the Apostle Paul committed. And yet God sat down with him, so to speak, and reasoned with him because Paul turned to him. He turned from his wicked ways. He turned from sin. And he started reasoning with God. And look at what God did with his life thereafter. Paul had a bit of experience with intellectual vanity, with how dangerous higher education really and truly was in his day. He was part of the problem. Highly educated, even in the Old Testament scriptures. And yet there he was on his way to Damascus, ready to kill and incarcerate true Christians, and thinking all the while that he was doing God a favor. Little did he know. I took you 2 minutes over, but we're not going to charge you for any of that extra time. I did it because it's the fastest moving hour in broadcasting, even for me. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Thanks for joining us on today's show, and we'll see you tomorrow.